employee.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the Catholic Opinion. My name is Father Anthony Sumich of the Priestly Fraternity of St. Peter. Welcome to our show this Friday. And let's begin today's program with a prayer. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Ghost. Amen. Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Amen. So as I said, my name is Father Anthony Sumich. I'm a priest of the Priestly Fraternity of St. Peter, a Society of Apostolic Life, working here in the Catholic Diocese of Auckland under the invitation of Bishop Patrick Dunn, the Ordinary or Bishop of the Auckland Diocese. We were invited into the Auckland Diocese 5 years ago to administer to those people of the diocese who feel the need to participate in the traditional sacraments of the Church in the form that was in existence prior to the Second Vatican Council. Now, what with the motu proprio, which was put out only a few days ago by our Holy Father, we need to reassure everybody that as far as we know, the diocese are still very much in support of the work that we do. We've been supporting them the whole time we've been here. And so we continue as business as usual, bringing the sacraments to everybody in their traditional form. Our Sunday Masses still remain a 9 a.m. Sunday Mass at St. Paul's College in Richmond Road in Ponsonby. And that's a sung Mass. And our daily Masses for the rest of the week are at St. Anne's Chapel in Te Aratu South. You can find all the information about this on our website at fssp.nz. That's fssp.nz, or our Facebook page, FSSP Auckland. So you're welcome to have a look at those. You can see many of the parochial or chaplaincy events that we have, our elderly group, our mother's group, our young adults group, our children's groups, our Samoan group, and many of the other things that we have, especially our sacramental program, the formation of the sacraments, and daily confession as well. So over the last few years in the show, I have been talking about the history of the Catholic Church in throughout the world, and last week we were specifically talking about the period of time when the Turks, the Ottoman Turks, were spreading out and advancing through Western, or through the eastern parts of Europe, up through the Balkan Peninsula. And as we talked last week, we were talking about the siege of Belgrade and the work of St. John Capistran in Belgrade, as he had said Mass in the morning. The great defender of Catholicism, John Hunyadi, and how the two of them were leading the defense against the Turks in Belgrade. And the fighting even got into the streets, almost every building. And the artillery of the Turks was no longer able to help the attackers once they got through the breaches in the walls. So it became apparent after some time the Christians were prevailing and some of the Turks were retreating back through the breaches. So by noon, the city was virtually clear of the Turks, and the Turks had been fought out, but Hunyadi and Capistran were not done, realizing that this is not just a one-battle thing. In the early afternoon, they counterattacked, streaming through the wrecked walls and into the fields beyond at a measured pace, with the 71-year-old Franciscan, incredible that he was fighting at this age, St. John Capistran, and he was still holding up his crucifix. That was what he was taking into battle. Hunyadi seized some of the Turkish guns and turned them on their makers. An arrow found its mark in the Sultan's body. Though the wound was not serious, it underscored his defeat. And in the evening, he was in full retreat, abandoning his camp and the city. So for the moment, at least, the infidel advance had been halted. Pope Calixtus III called it the happiest event of his life. In the full heat of summer, the thousands of unburied corpses in and around Belgrade rotted and bred disease, and the consequent plague carried off both the victors, Hunyadi after only a few days, the lean and whipcord tough Capistran only after 3 months of struggle. In the long sweep of history, the victory of Belgrade was of only marginal significance for Christendom, but it did hold up the final Turkish triumph in the Balkans for an entire generation, along with the remarkable fight waged by the ex-Muslim and reconverted Christian Skanderbeg, or George Kastriota, in Albania, whom Pope Calixtus III, in December of 1456, named Captain General for the Turkish War, and who maintained a successful resistance until his death in 1468. But the triumph at Belgrade just shows what might have been done by a united Christendom and a great martial pope at the siege of Constantinople. So there's a gap in the record of the Portuguese exploration of the African coast between the years 1448, when the unique Chronicle of the Discovery and Conquest of Guinea by Gomes Yanes de Zurara comes to an end, and the beginning of the personal narrative of his African voyages by Alvise de Cadamosto of Venice, who first arrived in Portugal and saw Prince Henry, the navigator, in 1454. So there's a gap there of some 6 years. In January of 1455, Pope Nicholas V issued the bull Romanus Pontifex, granting Prince Henry authority over all Christian voyages and exploration in and around Africa, as far as the dwelling place of, quote, the Indians who are said to worship the name of Christ, unquote. A follow-up bull called Inter Cetera, issued by Pope Calixtus III in March of 1456, gave the Portuguese Order of Christ, of which Prince Henry was the governor, quote, ecclesiastical and ordinary jurisdiction in the islands, villages, harbours, lands and places acquired or to be acquired from Capes Bojador and Nun as far as and through all Guinea and past that southern shore all the way to the Indies. So the dating of these two bulls has caused confusion because of the failure of some historians to take note of the practice at this time of beginning the new year on March 25th in dating papal documents, causing these two bulls to be dated a year earlier than their correct date according to the modern calendar. So the interpretation of the language used in these bulls is of critical importance in determining what Prince Henry the Navigator, who undoubtedly requested and possibly drafted them, saw as the goal of his great exploring enterprise towards the end of his life. No earlier document specifies India as his objective. These seem to do so, though it has been argued that Ethiopia, often confused with India in the vague visualizations of lands beyond the Muslim barrier, which Christians had in that age, was meant. Ethiopia was Christian and was on the other side of Africa, but though the term India was sometimes used to mean Ethiopia, that land was really, if ever, referred to as the Indies, the name Columbus gave to the islands of the Americas. And though he always thought that they were part of Asia, he certainly never thought them part of Ethiopia. Zurara, in his chronicle, speaks of Indians and Ethiopians separately. At the very least, it would seem reasonable to assume that though the term India might be extended to include Ethiopia, it nevertheless still included the actual India, where there were also many Christians who traced their history back to the Apostle Thomas. And there's no doubt that the Christians of either India or Ethiopia, or both, were among the major objectives of Prince Henry's explorations. So there's a good reason to conclude that at least by this point, Henry the Navigator did intend for his ships to go around Africa all the way to India, wherever it was, of course. In June of 1455, Cadamosto and his associate Antonioto Usodimare of Genoa sailed as far as the Gambia, where Diogo Gomes followed them in 1456. Gomes sailed far upstream on the broad estuarian river, reaching the city of Cantor and meeting there the black chief Nomi Mansa, who requested baptism. Gomez had no priest with him, and though a layman is entitled to baptize, Gomez apparently did not feel capable of judging the religious purity of Nomi Munster's intentions. He said he would ask Prince Henry to send a priest, and yet, unfortunately, we have no record of whether or not he did. In 1456, Cadamosto made a second voyage, on which he discovered the Cape Verde Islands, about 300 miles west of Cape Verde in the Atlantic. He returned to the Gambia and then sailed south 150 miles to the Bijagos Archipelago off the coast of what was later to be called Portuguese Guinea and today Guinea-Bissau. After that, for lack of records, the curtain falls until the beginning of 1460, when Pedro de Sintra, with two caravels, reached Sierra Leone, which he named Lion Mountain, either for a fancied resemblance to the shape of a crouching lion or for the thunder that roared over it. Sierra Leone is 250 miles southeast of the Bijagos Archipelago, and it is unlikely, though possible, that Pedro de Sintra covered that much coast as new exploration. Unrecorded voyages in 1457, 1458, and or 1459 are likely to have opened up part of it. Prince Henry's instructions to each voyager continued to be to go as much farther along the African coast beyond the last point explored as he possibly could, though not all obeyed these orders. Prince Henry the Navigator died at Sagres on November 13 and 1460 at the age of 66, having lived all his life as a lay celibate, wearing a hair shirt and carrying a fragment of the True Cross. And he was buried in the Portuguese royal shrine at Batalha Abbey. Few men who ever lived have influenced history more. When he was born, ocean seafaring hardly existed in Europe. Even the Norsemen had lost most of their skill and could barely sail to Iceland, while Greenland and American Vinland beyond had faded into the mists of time. Christendom was geographically entrapped by the Muslims, cut off in a small corner of the globe, unable to reach the rest of humanity. When he died, the bolder mariners of his country had been exploring for 40 years and were drawing kindred spirits from all over Europe. The goal of rounding Africa had been set and approved by two popes. Long as the sea road was, there was no doubt that eventually it would be traversed. And the impetus of that achievement would drive explorations elsewhere, including that of Columbus across the Atlantic Ocean. It had recently become fashionable to decry the expansion of the West to the Orient and Africa and the New World, and to assert or imply that it would have been better if these regions and peoples had never encountered the West. Such things as colonization were frowned upon, or are frowned upon seriously in this day and age. The conflicts, the misunderstandings and bloody wars which arose out of these encounters, and especially the immense evil of black slavery to Europeans, seem at first sight to support this view. So devout a Catholic as Prince Henry the Navigator should assuredly have recoiled from the horrors of slavery when he saw them displayed before his eyes when the first human cargo from Africa was discharged at Lagos in 1444. But the human story since Eden is always laced with evil, which good must fight incessantly. The Christian faith provided the spiritual resources to fight and in substantial part to defeat the evils that arose from Christendom's contacts with new cultures during the Age of Discovery. Slavery was eventually abolished in Christendom. There is not the slightest indication that, outside of Christendom and without the Christian example, its abolition would ever have been thought of anywhere else. Strip away the romantic veneer from the Orient, from Africa, before Prince Henry, from America before Columbus, and an abyss of tyranny and horror opens that looks more like Gehenna than Eden. It is not considered polite to mention these things today, but in justice, they must be spoken of. The million victims of the thug strangler cult and the millions of innocent widows burned on their husbands' funeral pyres in India. The most painful of all deaths, the mutilated parade of the court eunuchs and the bound-footed woman in China, the vicious female circumcision practice in much of Black Africa, the 80,000 human sacrifices at 15 seconds per man during the dedication of the temple in Mexico City in 1487, and the island populations literally devoured by the Caribs in the New World Sea that still bears their name. These vast and ancient evils Christendom would destroy. And for their destruction, the Church of Christ has the right to ask thanks, not condemnation, from the people she delivered from them. This is, of course, not to talk about or not to dismiss the evils that came from colonization or even the money-making side of it, which enslaved so many peoples, which, of course, according to the gospel, is always a great crime. Back in England, the tragic King Henry VI recovered his sanity, more or less, at the end of 1454, but was even less capable than he had been before of controlling the fractious barons or his strong-willed wife Marguerite. In May of 1454, Richard, the Duke of York, who had been regent during the king's insanity, gained physical control of him after a battle in which York's principal rival, the Duke of Somerset, was killed. But the Queen remained influential and bitterly opposed to York. Gradually, she prized the helpless monarch out of York's control, formed her own faction of the nobility, and forced York out of England to Ireland in October of 1459. Meeting the next month, what many called a parliament of devils at Coventry, consisting almost entirely of enemies of York, attainted him, his son, and the Earls of Salisbury and Warwick, who were his chief supporters. England was split between supporters of Henry VI, as managed by Queen Marguerite, the Lancastrians, and supporters of the Duke of York, the Yorkist, whose emblems were respectively a red and a white rose, hence the War of the Roses. There was a genuine issue of title to the throne between them, puzzling and petty as questions of royal title seem to a post-monarchical generation. Rightful royal title was then the basis of legitimate government. Though questionable royal titles might not be widely challenged under a good and effective government, they were sure to be when government was incompetent. The victories of Henry V had cast their luster before and after him, quieting objectors for many years. But the fact was that his father, Henry IV of Lancaster, son of John of Gaunt, was a usurper who had seized the throne of England illegally from Richard II. By strict hereditary succession, the next in line for the throne after the childless Richard II was his uncle Lionel, his father's oldest brother, who had died in 1368 and whose grandson Roger died, 1368, and his grandson Roger died in 1398 before Richard's overthrow. But Roger left a younger son and daughter. The son died without issue. The daughter, Anne, in fact, the rightful queen, though she never claimed the throne, married Richard, Earl of Cambridge, second son of Richard II's third uncle Edmund, whose older son died childless. Richard, Duke of York, in 1459, was the oldest son of Richard, Earl of Cambridge, and Anne, the great-granddaughter and only heir of Prince Lionel, thus combining in his person two royal lines of descent, the line through his mother being clearly superior by primogeniture to the title of Henry VI, great-grandson of John of Gaunt. So if that hasn't left you completely confused, nothing will. Henry VI, left to himself, would probably have been happy enough to abdicate, and Queen Marguerite, who was hardly in a pleasant position, with a half-mad and always futile husband dwelling in a foreign land surrounded by enemies, might have been bought off were it not for the presence of her baby son and only child, Edward, whose rights she was naturally determined to defend to the end. Whether little Prince Edward had paramount right to the throne was the legal issue. the actual outcome of the dispute over his title depended on how many noblemen adhered to one cause as opposed to the other, and how well they were led. There is no immediate Catholic significance in all of this, though the story of the War of the Roses is a much more compelling human drama than most students of it have realized. But the outcome of the 25-year struggle was to be of very great significance, because it brought the Tudor dynasty to the English throne, and it was the Tudors who took and kept England out of the Catholic Church in the next century. In a battle at Northampton in July of 1460, the Yorkists, led by the Earl of Warwick and supported by the City of London, defeated the Lancastrians and once again seized possession of the king. In September, the Duke of York returned from Ireland, and the next month he claimed the crown. Parliament was not quite ready yet to give it to him. They prepared a compromise whereby Henry VI would continue as king for the rest of his life, but accept York as his heir, disinheriting his son, Edward. Since Edward's rights were the real issue, the Lancastrians could not be satisfied with this arrangement, and Queen Marguerite would never accept it. In December, the tables were turned at the Battle of Wakefield. The Duke of York was killed, along with his second son, Edmund, and the Earl of Salisbury, one of his two principal supporters among the nobility. But his eldest son, confusingly also named Edmund, a very capable leader and commander, despite his youth, as he was only 18, immediately stepped into his father's place, winning a major victory at Mortimer's Cross in February of 1461. 2 weeks later, in another part of England, Queen Margaret's army defeated the Earl of Warwick. But Edward of York reached London first and rallied its people, who on March the 4th acclaimed him King Edward the 4th. At Towton on Palm Sunday of 1461, Edward won a long, bloody, hard-fought and decisive battle over the Lancastrians and apparently secured his power permanently. Queen Marguerite fled to Scotland, taking Henry VI and little Prince Edward with her. But Queen Marguerite was dangerous so long as she lived, and Edward IV not as secure as he thought in the heady wake of his victory at Towton. The disintegration of government and society in England had gone on too long. The aftertaste of defeat in France was too bitter, and the examples of successful rebellion had been too many for the restoration of real peace and good order in the land without a long period of further struggle. The conflict was to continue, with periodic remissions for 24 years after the Battle of Towton, until, through a series of events demonstrating anew that truth is stranger than fiction, and involving the most impenetrable historical mystery in the annals of England, it brought down the ancient and renowned House of Plantagenet after 14 generations in power, and placed the grandson of a Welsh clerk on the throne of William the Conqueror. So we will now shift our emphasis now across to that of Naples and Sicily, whereby King Alfonso V of Aragon, Naples and Sicily, died in June of 1458 without legitimate issue. Honouring the terms of his father's will, he provided for the succession in Aragon to pass to his brother Juan, while reserving Naples and Sicily for his illegitimate son, Ferrante. Old Pope Calixtus III, his countryman and former minister, knew the potential of endless trouble for the papacy in the rule of the southern part of Italy by a powerful non-Italian king, and declared he would not recognize Ferrante. But Calixtus III outlived his former master only 6 weeks, passing away in the hot and sultry August, which had always been Rome's dying time. The outspoken, committed, and militant old man had been an inspiration to the best spirits of in a Christendom still reeling from the shock of the fall of Constantinople. But there had not been enough open to inspiration. The victory of John Hunyadi and St. John Capistran in Belgrade in 1456 had not been followed up. and in an earlier act of family partiality in 1456, Calixtus III had stored up coals of fire for the church in the future. He had made his young and licentious nephew, Rodrigo Borgia, a cardinal at the age of only 25. The conclave for the new pope met on August 16th with 18 cardinals present, 8 Italians, 5 Spaniards, 2 very influential Frenchmen, 1 Portuguese, and the 2 Greeks, Bessarion and Isidore. The highly respected Cardinal Capranica had almost unanimous support as the next pope when Calixtus III died, but he died unexpectedly 2 days before the conclave assembled. The first ballot showed no clear leader. Then the French Cardinal d'Estouville made a vigorous effort to gain the necessary votes and came within 1. But the able and well-liked Aeneas Silvius Piccolomini, who had come so far since his days as a supporter of the schismatic Council of Basel, never gave up and eventually swung the college in his favour. In the first ballot of the second day of voting, he gave him their votes. He had 9 of the votes to 6 for d'Estouville, and one by one, the other 3 cardinals gave him their votes, beginning with the astute Rodrigo Borgia, who probably hoped thereby to curry favour from Piccolomini as Pope. If so, he totally misjudged his man. Piccolomini was proclaimed Pope Pius II at the age of 52 with great rejoicing in Rome. He was known as a good and charitable and persevering man, friend to all, but impossible to manipulate, an outstanding diplomat and a brilliant writer. However, few, if any, saw him as a crusader. But the crusade to regain Constantinople became his primary goal as pope, though unattained. Less than 2 months into his pontificate, on October 12, 1458, in a lengthy speech to the cardinals, bishops and prelates and ambassadors in Rome, Pope Pius II reviewed the defeats inflicted upon Christians by the Turks, and he showed how the Turks aimed at the destruction of all Christendom. He declared an immediate counterattack was necessary and called a congress at Mantua in Italy for the following June to plan it. Soon afterward, reversing his predecessor's policy, he recognized Ferrante as King of Naples as his contribution to a policy of peace within Christendom to facilitate a united effort in the Crusade. But the Congress of Mantua proved a bitter disappointment to Pope Pius II. When it opened on schedule, not a single Christian prince was present in person, nor had any sent a representative with plenipotentiary powers. Those they had sent were little more than observers. Pius wrote immediately to Holy Roman Emperor Frederick III, strongly urging him to come. He was the temporal head of Christendom, the natural leader of a crusading army. He was needed above all. But Frederick, involved in a dispute with the Duke of Bavaria and seeking to secure for himself the crown of Hungary, did not respond. In August, one major delegation finally arrived at Mantua, the large and brilliantly accoutred embassy of Duke Philip of Burgundy. It might well be said that all their promises and posturing bore a faint odour of spoiled pheasant, but by the time Pius II was so eager for support from any official quarter that he took the Burgundians at face value. The Italian city-states would not break away from their parochial concerns. Florence would only offer help secretly, and Venice not even that. In October, envoys from the Duke of Savoy and Duke Albert of Austria, brother and foe of Emperor Frederick, arrived, but they were no help. The Austrian envoys openly insulted the Pope. Matters became even worse when in November, Duke Sigmund of Tyrol arrived with a vehemently anti-papal propagandist Gregor Heimberg in his train. Heimberg had played a leading part in supporting the schismatic Council of Basel and had not changed his views. And when French envoys came later in November, they made sure the Pope understood that their master, Charles VII, had no intention whatever of revoking the pragmatic sanction of Bourges, which had removed the whole church in France from the Pope's administrative and governing authority. So all things were looking pretty bleak. But unfortunately for us, they're looking even more bleak, as we are almost out of time. So we'll hope to have you back again all next week. May God bless you, and have a happy and holy weekend. We'll see you in church. God bless.